Good afternoon. This is Wavelength on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm William English, and this is part three of an ongoing series on and around auto-destructive art and music. And today's guest is Mathieu Copeland, one of the curators of Voids, a retrospective held at the Pompidou in 2009. And also, was it the Kunsthalle Bern?
Absolutely, yep.
Yes, well, welcome, Mathieu. Thank you very much for coming in.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
I hope that Voids somehow proves to fit in with the idea of auto-destruction.
Well, it has. It would be the leftovers of auto-destruction, though.
Now, I think you went to... There was an event at the Café Otto last night.
There was indeed, yeah.
Where you were talking.
It was a panel discussion as well, yeah, organised by David Toop and The Wire. And that was a great, yeah, it was a wonderful, wonderful event and very well attended. And it's beautiful, pretty much posing the same stories as the one you're trying to highlight through Gustav Metzger and a broadening, of course, around the exhibition that David Toop has curated at John Latham's Flattime House.
Yeah, he has this show on at the moment called Blow Up, doesn't
he?
At the Flattime House in South London, I think runs to the end of July, I believe.
I would think so.
So what was the event last night exactly? There were three speakers, I think?
There was four of us, absolutely, yeah. There was four of us. And the idea was to talk about the... the idea of the time, so to say, of auto-destruction, of John Latham, but also to try to expand upon these ideas and see how these are still relevant to nowadays. And how, for instance, especially for me, would curating be a very fitted environment to still think and engage with these ideas?
Right, yeah. And your own background, you call yourself curator, but you also do other things. You have a record label.
I do have a record label, yeah, and yeah. I publish DVDs and by artists. And my passion's always been about curating and trying to see the limits of an exhibition and how we can extend and develop upon these.
Mm.
And that's why it was a great pleasure for me to work on the Voids retrospective, because that was, I believe, one of the limits one can reach when you think of an exhibition, which is when there's nothing, nothing to show.
So, the precise title of the exhibition was Voids, a Retrospective.
Absolutely, yeah.
As though there is actually now a history of Voids.
Well, there is indeed, and it's quite a long one. Mm. I mean, the history of the Void as a concept is one which goes very far, which, you know, you could go all the way to Taoism, to Buddhism, to Zen philosophies, or to, pretty much any kind of areas where the human mind has wandered and a theory of the Void would have come through. But that in modern art and contemporary art is an history which has been writing itself ever since, physically, 1958 and Yves Klein's exhibition, Le Vide. Mm-hmm. At the Galerie Risclair, but also before you would find example of the Void or touch upon the Voids. For instance, you would have Alphonse Allais doing the empty scores, or doing the those wonderful just white monochromes, pre-monochromes, talking about nothing.
Mm.
And
who was that again?
Alphonse Allais.
Okay.
And who just did this wonderful, I don't know the translation of that piece though. It was...
When did they date from?
That was 1890.
1890, oh right. Oh,
but wow. Of course that was just made, it was both very humoristic in a very historical approach to that, to nothing and the Void, but also it bared in within itself the seeds of what was to happen through Malevich, for instance, 20 years later.
Mm-hmm.
And through the one-on-one monochromes, you lead naturally to a nothingness, to an absence, to a Void, which really crystallized itself in the form of an exhibition through Yves Klein's show at the Galerie Risclair, when he decided to show nothing but the gallery. But all the way to the present time. And that's why we wanted to call that show retrospective, because we really wanted to focus upon the idea that it was a history that had been writing itself,
mm-hmm.
but a history which for us was fascinating. When I say us, because there was five of us who curated that show. There was Gustav Metzger, mm-hmm. Clive Philpott, John Armleder, Mike Perrin, and myself. And so we had been working on that show for about 3 years.
Mm.
And the reason why I say that is it's not just to make a statement about how much time it takes to do nothing. Everything everybody would know that doing nothing is the hardest thing to do. But also to go further than that, which is the idea of how to and that's why we call it a retrospective. It's just how to write the history of a form,
mm-hmm.
which has always been the same form. A form which is nothing, which is the Void, but how that form has always acquired a different meaning according to whom had done that Void.
Right.
So if I say it started in 1958 with Yves Klein, then through with Art and Language in 1966, then all the way through Robert Barry, Robert Irwin, and all the way to Roman Ondak in 2006, who also engaged with the same form of just leaving the gallery empty, but just by calling it up, calling the artwork a different manner, would portray, would characterize an all different meaning, an all different understanding of what could the void be. And that was the one of the engagement we wanted really to focus on.
So do you think that, is it the case then that Yves Klein was actually the first to leave the gallery empty?
Well, that was the first we could find ourselves. Right. I mean, you know, we'd been through the history we've made. And funnily enough, the show that I'm mentioning at the Galerie Iris Claire actually was not empty in itself. Uh-huh. But it was, he did call it David, even though he'd had a different title at first. But the thing, why we decided, though, to start the history with him was because, when I say it was not empty, what he did was he repainted the gallery walls white.
Yeah.
So even though it looked empty, it was not purely empty, as one would say. But in 1962, a couple of months before he died, Jacques Villiglé invited him to do a piece as part of a group show he was curating at the Musée d'Art Moderne de la Ville de Paris in a Salon Comparaison. And for this show, he decided to leave the gallery empty and did them, and this time without adding anything. But rather than referring ourselves to that second show of 1962, we decided to focus on the first one, 1958, because even though it was not purely to the form of emptiness and nothingness and the void, it was carrying all the seeds of what the void was to become. And himself, Yves Klein, started to call that show afterwards retrospectively Le Vide, and any of the artists afterwards with whom we've spoken in order to make and compile that history and create that exhibition, that retrospective, all referred to him as the first ones, really. Right. So that was the reason why we wanted to start.
It was originally called something else, wasn't it, that show? The exhibition, when he announced in some magazine or other.
Yeah, no,
it
had
some
indeed.
Long. We have with us this magnificent catalogue for the show. It's actually a very good catalogue called Voids from the Pompidou.
Yeah, and so the original title was The Specialization of Sensibility in Raw Material State into Stabilized Pictorial Sensibility.
Right.
So you can imagine how easy it was to remember The Void rather than that long title. But both of them carry the same meaning and the same understanding of what art could be, though.
Yeah.
And that's what I cherished.
But that's how he started with that. And wasn't there one show actually just before the one that I call it, is Iris Claire, is it?
It was in two galleries. It was both at Iris Claire and Colette Allendy. And what he decided to do was to show his blue monochromes, for which he was famous, but also to leave the first floor of Colette Allendy's gallery and there to present the zone of immateriality that he was thinking upon and working on, which was just leaving the first floor of the gallery empty. But then at the time, he was still trying to understand that the artwork would be invisible rather than be a void in itself. If you see the slight difference that I'm trying to make there.
I mean, the artwork would be there, but not visible.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which is not the same. It was different from actually putting nothing there at all.
Absolutely, yeah. And even though there was nothing, but for instance, what he decided to do in that show, in that Colette Allendy, was to have some spotlight looking straight up onto the wall, and so therefore creating a square of light. But the square of light was not the art. The intention of Klein was really to say that, no, this is illuminating the pure sensibility of a painting, if you see. So that was the first step towards him coming up to the void, coming up to that nothingness, coming up to that that quintessential absence that defines his art, the immateriality. Even though, and that's a great thing, that's one has to remember that there was the height of modernity, you know, that very turning moment between modernity and postmodernity. And what's very striking is, yes, when you think about it, when you start to show nothing, what you do show is not nothing, quite to the contrary. You show the gallery space in itself. Mm-hmm. And so therefore, you're turning the gallery into the work. But for him, it was not reaching yet that very moment. It was not reaching yet what would others, such as Michael Asher or Art and Language, would do and start working upon the first seeds of the institutional critique. For Yves Klein, was still very much trying to make art which would have a very Could I say that near religious feeling to uh-huh. that near a very aspect of a
spiritual
the completely spiritual understanding of what the art could be was mm. for the second void, so to say, after Klein, the one that we that was in the retrospective was a 1966 Art and Language, the air conditioning show, leaving the gallery empty, just calling the air conditioning device unit, but not the object itself, just the fact that the air being brassed in the gallery would be the artwork mm. in a long series of artwork that they'd been developing at the time.
Mm. And apparently at that time it was quite unusual for galleries to have an air conditioning system.
Absolutely, yes, that's so what they told me. Yeah.
Did they install it themselves, or was it an existing?
Well, it has a very interesting story, because even though the air conditioning show dates from 1966, it was not realized until the late 1960s by Joseph Kosis at the in New York at the School of Visual Arts. So it, and because through their name, we have to remember art and language, the language being the art. If you have the printed matter, the printed text upon the as the published calling the air conditioning, it was just enough for them to validate the fact that this was an exhibition. Mm. But as they told me when we were preparing the exhibition, of course, at the time in America and in the US, it was quite common to have air conditioning in the museums, but none at all in European museums.
Oh, right.
So it was quite striking that, yes, they told me many, many occurrences that people since have been wanting to meet that show, and them, of course, being really willing to for others to engage with that the air conditioning show.
Yeah.
But misunderstanding pretty much the statement by putting two huge air conditioning machines in the gallery space in order to show that, which was completely, you know, the opposite of the intention of that piece.
Yes, because then the contraptions become like sculptures almost.
Well,
sculptural objects.
Because de facto, if you have nothing but a big air conditioning unit in the gallery, one would read that whatever, you know, for better or worse, as an art piece.
Yeah. And so it's no longer a void.
Not quite to the contrary. So this was not their intention. I'm saying that this has
right.
been the misunderstanding that people have been doing about that.
Yeah.
But no, quite to the contrary. What's quite exciting for me thinking about that very piece, and that's when I really established a very strong difference between that of Yves Klein and that of Art and Language, is that you have the turning point here. You have the understanding that we're showing, well, the gallery does become the artwork, but furthermore than that, what we do not show the gallery, but the hidden system that underlies every museum and the way that they're being built nowadays. Just by, you know, all museums now have air conditioning, if only for entrance issues, just that they have to maintain the air to a certain temperature and to a certain flow in order for the intro to say, yes, I will insure that drawing for £15 million.
But, right.
Just the idea. Yeah. And so just by doing a show like that, just saying, yeah, that's the air conditioning, that's the art.
Yeah.
Just trying to, I think, carries forward a strong sense of humor, which is one of their arts, which I've always loved.
Mm-hmm.
But also carries a really strong element of criticism upon the museum and the institution which hosts the arts.
Right. I'm intrigued by the sort of what I call the sort of ritualistic attitude of Yves Klein.
Mm.
Especially to that opening show where there were apparently two Republican guards at the opening in full dress. I mean, it's quite. Can you describe
uniform.
The uniform? Because for people that aren't familiar with it, is it like the household cavalry or something?
Yeah,
it's like
it's
a sort of incredibly
very grandiose,
very grand. So there were two of these guys, one on either side of the door.
Absolutely, yeah. Well,
security guards, and then Yves Klein himself dressed up in a sort of like a Rosicrucian outfit.
No, that was for its wedding only. No, that's
really?
He just dressed up very nicely as he always did with them, but with a beautiful suit. But no, he wouldn't have done that for that opening.
Okay,
what they did is, so he has the two guards at the door. He had a beautiful blue velvet.
Curtain?
Yeah, curtain blocking the door. Yep. Well, not blocking the door, you know.
But that you had to part to get
to go through that. Mm. And then he went to the Coupole, which was a famous restaurant in Paris at the time, and then had them create a blue cocktail.
Right.
Based on blue methylene, and that everybody drank, so everybody peed blue the next day. That's a little story. But the great thing about that, though, because it was full of yes, there was a pompous ceremony behind that, but also there was... It was a great way to celebrate nothing by putting the extravagance of fullness next to it, which is always something quite radical that amplifies the idea of nothingness, therefore. And that's why the reactions have been quite violent and beautiful, though.
Yeah.
So you would have, there was more than 3,000 people turning up to his opening. And both here to see nothing. And also there was all these elements that that creates the paratext to that show being nothing, of course. But then there was you had to have a coupon in order to get in. And if you did not have a coupon, which was being sent to you by the gallery, you had to pay to get in. And the idea of Klemp making people to pay unless they invited people who would actually buy the work or something like that, the idea was that, but if they do come inside the gallery, by leaving the gallery, they will take bits of my materiality with them. So for them to pay to get in is actually a very cheap price. Mm. And that's one of the quotes I found.
Was he a Rosicrucian?
He was indeed, yeah. That's why for his wedding, he was dressed up very, very in the whole Rosicrucian outfit. But I did find some very interesting piece of writings by him when I was preparing the book on Nothing and on the Void, which was just before the show happened. He actually went to pray at San Rita all the way down in Italy and left, actually, something which had been rediscovered about 30 years later, which was shown as part of the last retrospective on Yves Klein, which happened at the Centre Pompidou again 2 years ago, which was a little crystal box filled with the pure blue, the pure pink, and the pure gold, and that was an offer to San Rita in order to protect him to do nothing, which I thought was wonderful. Yeah. And he'd say that, but then just jokes apart, he did say something beautiful in that letter that was all mentioning all that, which was you cannot do the void impunously. It bears a consequences to do nothing.
You can't do it what?
Impunously.
Never
mind. You can't. I mean, it
not
would
sure
have,
about that. It's quite interesting. You can't do the void without
consequences.
Without consequences.
Yeah.
Right. So it's sort of not exact. I'm trying to think of a more subtle word than backfires, but it can never be a void.
It's a violent gesture, just as simple as that.
Oh, you think it's a violent gesture?
Oh, well, I think it's extremely violent. Yes, of course. Yeah. And you. It's pretty much like playing sound, playing nothing, playing silence. It's how could you be more aware of yourself than when you're confronted to nothing but yourself? Because it's never about the architecture of the space. Of course, each of the voids, which were part of the retrospective, were made in situ for a very precise environment. But also, it was made in order to just envisage nothingness, absence, void, the pure absence of it. So, of course, you have a very strong and deep political meaning and reading to have into that. But also, you have a very strong reflection upon humanity about that, as much as upon the creation of objects and the American.
So, it's a sort of rejection of everything, or not,
or a celebration of everything. That's the thing, though. It can be both, but both of them are violent gestures in as much as it is one of the most radical gestures one could have. Mm. To dare do nothing. Many people, we did find hundreds and hundreds of exhibitions which were what we call near to nothing. Because you have to understand that in order to make that show, we had to define what we call nothing.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that nothingness, what we thought was that the artist decided to leave the gallery completely empty, not adding anything, not withdrawing anything. Hence the reason why Michael Usher was not part of the retrospective on them. Because all the shows that we did find of his, especially that famous show at Claire Cooper's gallery, where he decided to break down the wall, which was the separation between the office and the gallery space, and he just took it away. And that was a beautiful statement about the criticism of the art market, of course, and celebration of a type of void. But that type of void was also by withdrawing elements of the gallery. The only pure void that we found by him was another one he did at the same time in Halifax. At the gallery of the university, where he decided to leave the gallery completely empty but switch off the light. So hence again there was a question for us. Is switching off the light it's an intervention? It's not leaving the gallery as it is. So that's also one of the reasons. Well, of course we did speak with Martin Creed about the light on and off.
Yeah.
But there is an element there. It's not because it's hidden that it's not there. Same thing, for instance, we had one of the key elements when you think about that, about the void and nothing, is Robert Barry. And Robert Barry, having had a very thorough engagement with nothingness and absence throughout his career, and for instance, you know, by hiding within the gallery, you know, where you can't see that, a little radio transmitter that would just transmit a blip, but you wouldn't hear that. You would need to come with a radio to hear it. But that we did not consider as a void neither. It looked like nothing. There was nothing in the gallery. And that was a major piece, but we had long discussion together. And we knew that wasn't a void per se. It was an attempt reaching to the void. Same thing when he did the radiation piece, in which he went to the gallery and left them radioactive piles, you know, little batteries of radioactivity. There's nothing that you can see, but there's a physical element nonetheless. But what we did find, what we decided to engage together, was that piece that that Robert, excuse me, which that piece from 1966 also, which was another one, which was some places to which we can come and for a while be free to think about what we're going to do. And in bracket mark is from 1970. And what was exciting about that is was because that was the moment when he engaged with the idea of leaving the gallery entirely empty. But what was wonderful is that he did that piece in many different places, in galleries, but also in the entrance of a supermarket. Because really the call is for that, is for saying that we do not need to have art, you don't need a space to display that art. And you do not need to fill any space with art in order to have art neither.
I was sort of interested in the one, is there someone called Laurie something at the end?
Laurie Parsons.
Who was sort of almost gave up art wanted to remain completely anonymous.
She did completely give up art. That's one of the beautiful things about that show that she did.
So I mean, that to me sounds like a true true sort of auto-destructive artist to me. Is the artist who actually ends up giving up.
Yeah, further than that, actually. It was a very fascinating story because, she gave up art in 1995. I think. And so when I wrote to her about, you know, that we were working on that show and wanting to invite her, she had this marvelous word to say, do whatever you want. It has nothing to do with me. And I thought that was just perfect because she gave up doing art in 1994. But it was a long process that led her to that, to that decision. I mean, for her first show at the Lawrence Wong Gallery in 1988, she decided to leave the gallery to just collect detritus from the bank of the Hudson River in New York and just collect them and display them and just put them in a gallery.
Right.
And that was it. And once the show was over, it was just all thrown away afterwards. So it was. She always had this attitude of doing nothing, leading to nothing. And then afterwards in 1989, I think, she told all the galleries she was working with to stop selling her art. And then in 1990, for a third show at Lawrence Wong Gallery in New York, the same one where she did the detritus piece, she decided to leave the gallery entirely empty, to not do anything that one would have. And the only thing that she did was just to send an invitation letter to all the mailing list of the gallery. And the invitation letter, invitation card, only bared one thing, which was the dates of the show and the address of the gallery. No artist name and no name for the show. And that was a wonderful thing that she withdrew completely the idea that she's not going to sign the void. And then she also withdrew afterwards, after that turned to happen, from a biography, she withdrew that show.
Oh, right.
So she deleted it.
So it became invisible.
It became a nothing.
Right.
And that was very important to me, you see, because I had a long talk once I was preparing the book on Void the artist Ben Vautier. And Ben was fascinating because he told me, well, you know, he had a discussion with Yves Klein in 1961 about the void, the void that he did. And he said, well, you have to understand that there was one thing for Yves Klein. He always say, j'ai fait le vide. I did the void. The I was more important than the void. The person was always putting himself forward before the void itself. It was a statement, a signature. The ego was prevailing. Right. And with Laurie Parsons, you reach to a point where she completely withdraws the ego of the artist. It is a pure way of confronting yourself to nothingness. And also, I believe that's one of the reasons why we wanted to be so many, so to say, to five of us to do that exhibition, just to make sure that there would not be a conflict of ego, a conflict of interest at any point, that what we would be celebrating and focusing upon would be the void, would be that absence, would be just a celebration of nothingness. Sorry.
That's all right. We are kind of getting towards the end of our session. Now, I brought two records along, which I showed you beforehand. One is the Pavel Buchler, which is unrecorded parts of 10 John Cage records. the transitions between tracks. Or we've got I Hate Art Galleries by Felix Cuban.
I think I'm going to have to be at the I Hate Art Galleries.
I Hate Art Galleries. Should we play that? And then we'll see if there's any time left.
That would be a pleasure.
So thank you very much to Mathieu Copeland for coming in, curator of Voids. Next week, hopefully, I hope to have Michael Landy coming in to talk about his auto-destructive art. But let's try and play out with Felix Cuban and I Hate Art Galleries. It should be.
Kunst ist tot! I hate art galleries. I hate art galleries. I hate art galleries. I hate
the white walls.
I hate art galleries.
White
rose! I hate art galleries.